much for participating in what is the last of the classes for the academic year. God willing, we'll be starting up again in the fall. I will probably be sending out an email at some point to the class email list, looking for suggestions for topics for next year. I want to thank the Bayit for hosting, and Bayit and Shai Shamayim for partnering, and the lawyers from Winnipeg. See that? The ones who are here are on Zoom. The Winnipeg ones are the ones who are in person. Something's wrong with this picture. I want to thank Jeffrey Silver also for his help in preparing this, as well as to note, this program is dedicated by Jeffrey Silver in honor of the birthday of his granddaughter, Faye. Please note, if you're here for Law Society credit, welcome. Please make sure that you sign in the chat on the Zoom or on the sign-in sheet for those who are here in person. Please note, just to make it 100% clear, registering in advance is not the same thing as signing in. Signing in happens during the program, so even if you registered in advance, make sure that you sign in the chat. Also, if you could keep your screen on. My wife is a lawyer, but she's U.S. certified and practices with an American firm. And she says Law Society's there. They won't give you credit unless your screen is on during the Zoom. I'm waiting for the Law Society of Ontario to catch up, because it should be the rule. That's not the rule yet. Okay, so our topic this morning is ethical and effective crisis management for clients. This comes under professionalism topic 2.4, as I noted on the sheet, recognizing and being sensitive. I'm just going to mute everybody here. Recognizing and being sensitive to clients' circumstances, special needs, intellectual capacity, and so on. And specifically, what I want to talk about is the fact that Jewish tradition has a very strong focus on issues like reputation. And that's going to affect the way that Judaism looks at dealing with a crisis which potentially endangers personal or professional reputation. Jewish law mandates a full apology for wrongdoing which harms others. Can you apologize for things knowing that that might entail a legal risk, with a very interesting Canadian quirk on that? Very, very stereotypical Canadian, but it was very interesting to me, and we'll talk about that as we get into the topic. I want to talk about guidance that Jewish tradition offers regarding planning for future crises. I want to talk about the issue of transparency. We have a lot to talk about. One of the practices I've established for hybrid classes is, first of all, since those who are online can't see those who are in the room, and often it's hard to hear, and vice versa, so when something is said in one group, I'll repeat it for the other group. But I also try to rotate between the two groups. So when I pause and say, any questions, I'm going to identify either those in the room, any questions, or those online, any questions. Also, please don't write any messages to me in the chat. You should sign in the chat. That you should do, and that I get to look at later. But don't write me messages in the chat with questions or comments on it, because it's hard enough to monitor two groups. Doing the chat also, which is scrolling as people sign in, is a little bit too much for my skill level. Okay, so basically our four areas are planning for the crisis, apologizing when something's been done wrong, the messaging around a crisis, and finally, if we get to it, transparency at the end. I want to begin with a necessary definition. I want to know how you would define crisis. We talk about crisis management and counseling clients in a crisis. What exactly constitutes a crisis? And I'm going to ask those in person first. What can you define crisis? Preferably without looking at source number one. Yeah.
Presumably an acute event. It's not
an acute event that is negative in some way and is not the norm. That definitely captures certain elements that we associate with a crisis. I mean, technically a crisis can be building, right? I mean, you think of some of the events that people have called a crisis. You know, I think of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that was something that was building for a very long time before it suddenly exploded. But yes, there's some turn of events, often unanticipated, which makes things a lot worse than they were yesterday. So I think that's fair. Other thoughts? Those online, crisis definition?
Illness, divorce.
Right. So those are examples for sure. Illness or divorce would be
examples.
Definition. Yeah. So take a look at source number one, Timothy Coombs, and I enjoyed some of his articles on this topic in general. This seems to be his field. So W. Timothy Coombs, Protecting Organization Reputations During the Development and Application of Situational Crisis Communication Theory, which we're going to be talking about. I skipped the vignettes, by the way. I'm going to come back to them once we've just defined our terms. But if you look at number one, a crisis is a sudden and unexpected event that threatens to disrupt an organization's operations and poses both a financial and a reputational threat. I'm not sold on the idea that it has to be both of those. I think a financial threat is good enough. I think a reputational threat is good enough to qualify as a crisis. Nonetheless, crises can harm stakeholders physically, emotionally, and or financially, right? When you think of a product crisis, you have a company that makes some kind of food, and the food is contaminated in some way. So there's a physical threat to people. There's potentially an emotional threat in other ways. Some of the crises in which leaders of organizations betray the trust of those around them, of the vulnerable, financial crisis, of course. A wide array of stakeholders are adversely affected by a crisis, including community members, employees, customers, suppliers, stockholders. Crises threaten to damage reputations because a crisis gives people reason to think badly of the organization. So a lot of potential harm going in a lot of different directions from this sudden and unexpected event that threatens to disrupt everything. Is that, I think that's fair as a definition? Yeah, Michael, what?
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Okay.
I think that that's...
Okay, good. So that's certainly one way to do it. I did want to note for you a second paper in source number two, Crisis Management, a Historical Conceptual Approach for a Better Understanding of Today's Crises, in which they elaborate a little bit on the elements that are involved in a crisis. What constitutes a crisis is not easily agreed upon. However, despite lack of clarity, there are specific conditions of crises in the crisis literature. For example, crisis situations share six characteristics, which are rare, significant, high impact, ambiguous, urgent, and involve high stakes. I don't know if they all have to be true. I don't know that all of them are necessarily present, but in general, it's conveying, I think, a certain sense. Crisis involves a period of discontinuity, a situation where the core values of the organization slash system are under threat. This requires critical decision making. There is a destabilizing effect to the organization and its stakeholders, and an escalation of one or more issues, errors, or procedures are expected in this period. Bad and getting worse. I'm sorry?
I see, why would rare be in there?
So Michael asks, why should it be rare? Why is rare one of the factors? What would you say?
If you're in a constant state of crisis, then that's just the norm.
Right. So one answer here in the room is that being in a constant state of crisis means that that's just life. Right? You can't really call that crisis. I think that's one issue. I think another issue is there are sheets and a sign in over there next to, in front of Alan. I think another reason why a crisis should be rare is because of the way the community is going to look at it. Meaning, if you're in crisis all the time, your stakeholders are going to start really blaming you, and that's going to be something we're going to come back to. It becomes harder to justify and say, well, this was a crisis, when they say, yeah, but it happened yesterday also. So it's going to affect the way that the organization has to deal with it. Why is it that this is a topic for lawyers? In other words, why would this be part of the job of lawyers to provide crisis management for an individual or for an organization? Why is this a conversation? Those in the room first and then those online. Yeah.
For two reasons. One is very generally our clients tend to come to us for advice, even of a non-legal nature, but more specifically, a lot of crises can have either legal causes, illegal action, or legal implications. So I'm sure we'll talk about the apology stuff later.
Right. So I think one of the factors is, as was just mentioned here, what's your name?
Ben.
Okay. So Ben mentions one of the key points, which is you have legal knowledge, and that's important for the client to be able to draw on. Knowledge of the risks, the legal risks from the crisis, as well as knowledge of the risks from the steps that you take to manage the crisis. You know, some steps might be safe, some steps might not. I think that's part of it. Part of it is also, yes, they're used to asking the lawyer for advice, just, you know, overall. I think that's true. What else? I think there's more to be said. Those online, what do you have?
I think that clients would often draw upon our expertise to try to negotiate settlements or to navigate the crisis with the authorities, as it may be, because they basically want to detach themselves and interpose a third party that has a little bit more of knowledge and is not part of the crisis.
Good.
To advance their interests.
Right. So I think that's a key point. What Sergio just mentioned at the end is important, which is the role of the lawyer is often to provide a helpful outsider-insider perspective. Because on the one hand, you know the operation, you're invested in its success. On the other hand, you aren't actually charged with carrying out the operations, and you have a level of objectivity about what's going on. So you have, yes, the investment, but you also have perspective that those who are engaged in it don't necessarily have. I think there's another element as well, which goes back to the training that a lawyer has. Lawyers have training in analyzing complicated situations and breaking them down to their relevant components, right? Not unlike what goes on in training in Jewish law for rabbis. You have to look at a complicated situation and ask yourself, in what direction are the different things going? What are the factors that we have to consider? It looks very much like crisis management. I know when my wife was taking exams in law school, they had these hypotheticals. Right, where I'm just, you know, making something up, but someone is stepping off a bus, and there's a pedestrian who's walking along, and a pedestrian bumps into them, and they fall, and something rolls onto the bus, and the bus driver sees it but starts driving anyway, and it crushes it. Like, who's responsible for what in those circumstances? You're trained to analyze that, and that's really useful when you're talking about a crisis. So I think legal training is also very helpful. I don't think it's accidental that people will also sometimes turn to an accountant for this type of advice, because the accountant has that type of training as well, and also has that position of being invested in the organization without being the one who's actually carrying things out. And so, again, you know, for them, this may be useful. So that's what, you know, that's why this is a topic for lawyers, this issue overall. So before we launch into the first vignette, questions and comments? Anything to discuss further? I'm going to note again, since some people have joined, first of all, to make sure that you sign in the chat. And also, if you could turn your screen on, it's much better for me when I can see people. The Mac people who are here in the room, those are great. But the people I can see online, also great. All right, so let's go further then. Let's get into the first case. So take a look at vignette number one. I invented an organization called Fund Jewish. It took me a very long time of Googling to find a Jewish fundraising organization name that wasn't already taken. But I found one, Fund Jewish. There isn't even a fundjewish.org or .com at this point, although it wouldn't surprise me if by 11 o'clock someone will have this name. Nonetheless, you may not want it after you read the vignettes. So let's see the first one. Susan is hired as counsel to Fund Jewish, a Jewish nonprofit which raises money for social service organizations that benefit the needy. Fund Jewish has an excellent community reputation for quality of service, integrity, and communication with stakeholders. On her first day on the job, Susan meets with the Fund Jewish leadership, who ask what steps they should take today to reduce fallout from any crisis down the line. They assure Susan they don't know of any issue. This is purely prophylactic. It's just like, hey, you know, we're looking at our operation. We just want to know what if. What advice can Susan give from secular and Jewish perspectives? What advice can you give in advance that will be helpful for this organization? So the key point here, the starting point is, have a plan. Right? You need to develop a plan beforehand to be able to deal with a crisis if and when it comes up. And I'm doing this first from secular wisdom, and then we'll bring in the Jewish aspect after that. But I'm drawing here on a very good paper from Keystone Law, Crisis Management for In-House Lawyers. And they recommend the following steps. Number one, and this is just in terms of planning. No crisis has happened. No crisis is anticipated. But number one, as I put in a bullet point in source number three, gather stakeholders and specialists to assess the state of the organization. Meaning, you have to ask, how prepared are we for a crisis? Are we resilient enough to withstand a problem well? Where are our vulnerabilities? Gather stakeholders and specialists to assess possible crises. You know, what crises are we vulnerable to? What is it that I'm worried about? Right? And we have Fund Jewish, this fundraising organization. What potential crises are they vulnerable to? What would you say? Online or in person?
Cyber attack,
right. Right. You have potential concern. Gwendolyn mentions that. Who knows what can happen with their data being released, being stolen, so they simply don't have it. Ransomware, I would throw in as well, as part of that. Yeah.
Assuming their assets are not fully in cash, either market crash or fraud by an investment.
Right. What happens if their investments go bad? Either the market crashes or they invested with this guy Bernie Madoff and now they've got problems. Sergio, you were going to say that also?
Yeah, a couple of things. And this has actually happened to, I can't remember, a U.S. charity was embezzlement by directors or, mm-hmm. or executives. Also, you can have, anti-Semitic attacks, vandalism, how to deal with it,
right,
ransacking.
For sure.
Whatever it is.
Right. You've got embezzlement by people who are working for or volunteering for the organization. You have the possibility of physical attacks. You have the possibility, if we're dealing with a Jewish organization, a vulnerability to anti-Semitic attacks. All true. So they need to figure out what kind of crisis they could hit and how that could harm the organization and how they would respond to a crisis like that. What would they do? And it's really important in that context, not just, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll get back to that. They have to prioritize the interests that they want to take care of in the event of a crisis, right? They have to worry about, obviously, harm to human beings, just general basic, threats to life as a major consideration. But they have to worry about the stakeholders. They have to worry about financial assets. They have to worry about physical assets of the organization, the reputation of the organization. So they need to ask these questions and then obviously answer them. And not only answer them, but answer them repeatedly. It's not enough that you come up with your plan. You have to keep the plan up to date and you have to keep it accessible and rehearsed, as I wrote on there. There was something that came out, I think it was sometime the last few days. I saw an article online. You remember the Surfside building collapse in Florida a year ago? So there was a button that the security desk had available to use to alert people if they felt there was a threat. And there were these loud bangs before the collapse, and there was some time, but the security guard had not been trained in use of the button and had no idea what to do. You could have saved lives. So it's not just that we need a plan, but we need to make sure that everybody knows the plan and knows what to do, right? That's why in schools they have drills. That's, you know, that's what we're trying to take care of. Now, to bring this over to the Jewish side of things, Judaism is going to argue that planning is a must. And it's really almost obvious. Of course planning is a must. Nonetheless, the sources are good to go through. And I'm doing this part of it fairly briefly because I think it is hopefully somewhat evident. The argument that some bring is that you should not plan, you should just trust God. Now, you look at that and say, what is actually saying that? Like, you really believe that you can just, you know, say Hashem will take care of you? But I did bring you source number 4, Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, Ramban, because this has been invoked as practical guidance in certain halachic debates. There's a verse in the Torah, Tamim tiyeh im Hashem Elokecha, you shall be complete with Hashem your God, which Nachmanides explains in source number 4. I'm just using my English translation, but you can see the original Hebrew on the sheet. The meaning of you shall be complete with Hashem your God is that we are to dedicate our hearts to God alone and to trust that God alone engineers all and knows the truth of all future events. From God alone we should seek the future, from his prophets or from his pious ones, meaning the Urim v'Tumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest, that is consulted for guidance. Now you'll say, is this really intended as practical guidance? I will tell you that in debates about whether life insurance is appropriate for a Jew, in debates about whether genetic screening is appropriate for a Jew, this has been invoked. So before you say, well, it's obvious you're supposed to plan, I'll just tell you that it's not obvious to everybody. Not everybody looks at it and says, well, of course you should. However, it is well established in Jewish law and Jewish thought that we do plan. We don't say, don't worry about it, God's going to take care of it. If you take a look at source number 5, a classic responsum from Rav Moshe Feinstein in 1973, talking about testing of spouses for Tay-Sachs. So he writes, and again, I'm just going to read out my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew there. Since it is easy to check, one should realize that failure to check oneself will be like closing one's eyes before that which one could see. God forbid such an event would cause the child's parents extraordinary pain, and so it will be appropriate for a man who wished to wed a woman to test himself. It will be good to publicize this in newspapers and other media to alert people that there is such a test. It is clear this must be done privately, right? The point is not to broadcast to the world somebody's status, but they should be doing this themselves. That's his statement, and he views it as like, just keep your eyes open when you cross the street. No one suggests that Jews should say, well, I trust God, so when I cross the street, I keep my eyes closed. So you wouldn't make that suggestion when it comes to genetic screening, or, for that matter, the measure of life insurance. We have responsa on that saying, no, it's absolutely appropriate for a Jew to have life insurance. That's a Jewish law perspective. From a Jewish philosophy perspective, I brought you from Pirkei Avot, source number 6. Who is wise? One who sees what will happen, meaning one who anticipates. You look at what's coming next, and you take steps as a result of it. And we have concrete examples of that in Tanakh, as well as in Jewish history. If you remember, the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, introduces right in the beginning the transition of the monarchy from King David to King Solomon. And there's a hitch, right? Adoniyahu, King David's older son, wants to take the throne, and he actually holds a major campaign event when his father David is ill, trying to get public support. And then his wife Bathsheba and the prophet Nathan intervene in order to make sure, no, the monarchy is going to go to Shlomo, is going to go to King Solomon. In chapter 2 of the book of Malachim, of the book of Kings, we get King David on his deathbed advising his son Shlomo, his son Solomon. And he says to him, there's this general, Yoav. Yoav killed a whole bunch of people inappropriately against the will and, in some cases, the explicit instructions of King David. And he says to Solomon, listen, I want you to make sure he doesn't die of old age. And there was this fellow, Shimi ben Gera, who also was a rebel against the throne at a very precarious time. King David was dealing with, at the time, a revolt led by another son of his, Avshalom. And this fellow, Shimi ben Gera, comes out and throws stones at David and his group as they're on the run from Avshalom, and he curses him. And it's very important because Shimi ben Gera is a leader of the tribe of Benjamin, a tribe which was never that loyal to David in the first place. And there's a real threat here. David at the time let it go. He said, I'm being rebuked by God, and that's why this is happening to me. But he says to Solomon, again, act according to your wisdom with this one. The question then is, why is he giving that advice? Why is he saying this to Solomon? So you could look at it and say, he's settling old scores, right? Yoav, among other things, killed one of David's sons. So he's saying, get rid of him. That's one way to look at it. You could say, Shimi ben Gera also, he's settling a score. However, Don Isaac Abarbanel explains that's not what's going on for various reasons, but take a look at his conclusion in source number 7. He says, it appears to me regarding this, our master David did not command Solomon to kill Yoav and Shimei for their first sins, what they did originally, for which he didn't kill them. David didn't do it. He did not set his son, young, soft, newly anointed as king, such dangerous counsel to kill these men of chayil, men of substance, at the start of his reign. Rather, his thought and intent was to tell Solomon what Yoav and Shimei had done against him so that he would be careful of them, not give them power in his house, lest they overpower him and do to him as they had done to David. He's warning him, these people are dangerous people, keep your eyes on them. Plan for the crisis. That's what he's trying to do. He's giving him instructions. We have an old tradition in Judaism, centuries and centuries old, of preparing what are called ethical wills. Right? We talked about that when we had a session on wills a while back. An ethical will is when somebody says, I want my children to have my advice for life. I want them to gain the messages that I gleaned. Writing that out for one's children is essentially a form of crisis management, right? That's what you're trying to do. You're planning ahead. That's what this is. So crisis management and planning in advance is a very Jewish thing. The other piece of what this organization should be doing, this organization that, you know, Fund Jewish, that has brought in Susan as counsel, is that you have to clean up your current messes in order to make sure that future messes don't become worse. You have to make sure that you've cleaned up whatever happened until now. We're going to talk about in a little bit situational crisis communication theory. One of the major points that they make is that people's reaction to an organization's crisis now is influenced by how the organization responded to previous crises. What did they do then? How did you deal with stakeholders in the past? If they feel like you've been bad to stakeholders in the past, if they feel like you were sloppy about responding to a crisis in the past, when the new one comes up, you're ready behind the eight ball. So one of the ways to prepare for a future crisis is to look at what has happened in the past. Prior relationships matter a great deal. And I brought you two sources on this from a Jewish perspective on the sheet. Number one, the Gemara in Ksuvos, which talks about the reciprocal quality of chesed. When people do things for others, the result is that others will act for them. One who eulogizes others will be eulogized. One who buries others will be buried. One who bewails the death of others will have others bewail theirs. One who escorts others to burial will be escorted. One who carries others to burial will be carried. Meaning that somebody who has a reputation for acting on behalf of others, others will be willing to act for them. I realize that that's a more utilitarian approach than we like to take to these activities. We'd like to think people just do this because it's the right thing. Nonetheless, know that what you do is going to ultimately rebound for you, for good in this case, or for bad in source number 9. Source number 9 tells the story of Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was descendant of the Davidic line, leader, political leader of the Jews in this, there were three Rabban Gamliels, but the one we're talking about is end of the second century Common Era, if I remember correctly. No, sorry, not correct. He's end of the first century, Common Era. And Rabban Gamliel believed that you really need a strong leadership. You need somebody who is going to command respect from the community. That was very important. And so he deals in that way with Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua was sort of second man in the Beis Medrash, in the study hall. And there were multiple occasions in which Rabbi Yehoshua differed with what Rabbi Gamliel said. And Rabbi Gamliel tormented him for it. He wanted everybody to stay in line. He felt that there was a real risk of rift if you didn't have one party line at this vulnerable time in Jewish history after the destruction of the Second Temple, living under the Romans. He felt we needed one way. Well, this story happens here. Source number 9, the bottom of the sheet, you see the Hebrew and my English. Once a student came before Rabbi Yehoshua and asked, is Arvit optional or obligatory? Arvit, the evening prayer? He wants to know, is that optional? Or is that something you have to do, like the other two daily prayers? So Rabbi Yehoshua replied, optional. It's optional. The student came before Rabbi Gamliel, who ruled differently. I skipped the actual back and forth in the story. Rabbi Gamliel finds out that this student has asked Rabbi Yehoshua and gotten a different answer. And so he then raises the question publicly in the study hall the next day. He says, does anybody disagree with me? Rabbi Yehoshua doesn't speak. And Rabbi Gamliel says, I heard you said something different. And he says, stand up. And he has him stand during the public lecture. So Rabbi Gamliel sat and taught. Rabbi Yehoshua stood on his feet until the entire assembly complained and said to Chutzpit, the translator, whose job is to explain and to amplify the lecture being given, halt. They said, stop. And he halted. And they said, how long will he continue to pain Rabbi Yehoshua? Last Rosh Hashanah he pained him. In Bechorot he pained him. Now he pained him. Let us remove him. In other words, the way you dealt with people in the past affects the way they're going to respond to you in the future. You got away with it once in the story where there was a debate about how to set the calendar and what day should be Yom Kippur. You got away with it in a second story. The third time already, they're not willing to let you get away with it. So clean up the old mess in order to make sure that the new one doesn't come back to bite you. You follow? That's the idea. Okay. But let's move from plan. Actually, questions and comments before we move into the second part. No, we're good? Okay, let's move into the second part. The second part was very interesting to me. I learned something brand new to me about the way things work in Canada. It says vignette 1 on the sheet. It should say vignette 2. Sorry, before source number 10. But go back to the first slide anyway, and let's read the case. Not long after Susan begins work for Fund Jewish, the organization learns that Richard, their director of fundraising, has been directing contributions into his own pocket, right? New meaning to the word director. The organization has never experienced anything like this. Richard had no record of such activity in the past, so they've never had this happen before. But it does appear the leadership missed clear warning signs, as Richard provided incomplete financial information at meetings over the past year. The CEO wants to issue a full, transparent apology, but she is concerned about potential legal fallout from admitting guilt. What advice can Susan give regarding apologies from secular and Jewish perspectives? That's the question here. So you tell me, first those online and then those in person. What informs our opinion here about apologizing? Yes, Michael.
One thing that I think is important is that in Ontario, there's actually a piece of legislation called the Apology Act.
Yes, there is. We're going to come back to that, so I'm going to ask you to hold that.
Okay.
You are 100% right. I just I'm not there yet. I will be there in source number 18.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Who else?
I'll speak up here. Lamaito Ellis, what does this apology do? Business-wise, there's nothing to this. There's no purpose. There's no gain.
So Mark is ruthless. Mark says, what's your point in apologizing? Why in the world would you do that from a business perspective?
I would word it a little bit differently and say, is it going to cause any damage?
Sorry?
You don't want to do anything that's going to cause damage to your organization, which is your first responsibility.
Right.
If you're going to apologize and that's going to bring the roof down on you, then you have to find some other way of doing this, I would think.
Right. So we have another argument that says, ask the question, can it harm my organization? If it can harm my organization, then I shouldn't do it. Yeah.
Just thinking, I mean, a business reason would be that if it's going to come out eventually, then they'll lose all credibility and they'll lose donations. But if they're forthright about it, then that's how they retain their credibility.
Right. You have an issue of retaining credibility. Mark disappeared here. But there's an issue of retaining credibility, and you're saying the apology will help you to retain credibility. I think that's a safe statement. Yes, Ben.
More so than a for-profit organization, a charity basically sells trust that the charity is going to do what it does. You know, if
right.
Apple screws up, if you still like their product, you'll still buy their product. If a Jewish charity screws up, why would I give money to an organization I don't trust?
Right. So there's a major practical point here, which is, I like the way you framed that. I'm going to write that down. That charities, in fact, their product, so to speak, is trust. So you don't apologize, you lose people's trust. You damaged our relationship. We don't want to, we're not going to invest in you anymore, essentially. That's a potential concern. Other things to add, online or in person.
We're not talking about a public information, though, are we? This is something that the board or whoever it is that it's the administrators.
No, I'm talking about where it's public. Everybody knows it happened.
Oh.
People are aware. Yeah, no, word is out. I mean, the truth is that when you apologize, more people will be aware. Right? Right now, a certain percentage of the population are aware. You apologize, more people will become aware. Gwendolyn.
You also have to be careful how you apologize.
Mm.
Non-apology and probably do more harm than good. If you're going to apologize, you can even frame it as there are things we could have done better. It's
right.
Not even an admission of wrongdoing, it's just we can improve and these are the steps we're doing.
Right. Right. So Gwendolyn makes 2 points, at least I'm hearing 2 points. Point number one is if you're going to apologize, apologize. Right? If somebody was offended by my tweet, is not an apology. Right? That's just not. And it doesn't help you, it only hurts you. That's number one. Number two is you can apologize without exposing yourself to litigation. It's all in what exactly you acknowledge happened. And I'm going to come back to that because that is definitely part of our conversation. To be clear, apologies are a really, really good idea, if not absolutely required in all situations. From a secular perspective, there was a great article. I had a lot of fun with this article. I gave you the link. It's in source number 10. Journal of Dispute Resolution, Legal Consequences of Apologizing. And they point out several things. I'm not yet going to read source number 10. I want to point out some things they point out first. Number one, apologies are important for healing. When people have been injured, whether that's a physical injury, a financial injury, a loss of trust, an insult, whatever it is, they need to receive an apology as part of the healing process. It helps them when the person they saw as hurting them seems to feel bad or says, I never intended for that to happen. It's psychologically important. It can be important for the aggressor, the person who did the harm, to regain their self-respect. Apologizing is part of saying, I am a good person. I'm not trying to harm people. But also, they make the point that on a practical level, it's valuable to apologize. And some of this is what was already said about trust and nonprofits. But take a look at now at number 10, where they point out, an apology properly given and accepted diffuses anger and helps avoid litigation. Sometimes obtaining an apology is an object of litigation. They're not looking for payment. They're not looking to take down the organization. They just want somebody to admit what was done. And yes, it's true that sometimes they'll say, that's all I want, but it's not all they want. Nonetheless, they note here, footnote 18 in that article, which I brought in source number 10, they bring a study which says it has been found in the medical malpractice arena that when physicians are honest about what has happened and accept responsibility, patients are less likely to sue. So from a practical perspective, this is a really good idea. Not only that, take a look at source number 11, where they talk about juries in the United States. This section covers attorney discipline. They give a few different areas in which apologies are relevant, and right now they're talking about attorney discipline. Such cases are distinct from tort cases in that the issue is not damages, but whether or not the attorney is fit to practice law. The cases reviewed included a discussion of apology as a mitigating factor and the lack of apology as an aggravating factor. The apologies the courts looked for were self-initiated expressions of sorrow, regret, or remorse to the injured clients, as well as remorse generally before the court. Self-initiated restitution to injured clients was also very important. Don't stop with the apology. The restitution is also a good idea. But they emphasize that the jury will see apologizing as a mitigating factor. So in terms of healing, helping them get over it, in terms of the person who made the mistake in the first place, and in terms of practicality, it makes sense to apologize. Again, there may be limits on what's good for the organization, but in general, it makes sense. I'm going to switch over to the Jewish side of it now, and then, Mark, I'll take your hand. But I want to do the Jewish side of it first. So in Judaism, we distinguish between laws that are ben adam l'makom, between a human being and God, and ben adam l'chavero, that are between human beings. Between a human being and God, if you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, in the very beginning of his Hilchos Tshuva, his laws of repentance, he says, regarding every biblical mitzvah, commandment to do something, as well as a don't do, a prohibition, when one violates any of them, whether intentionally or in error, and he performs tshuva, he repents, and returns from his sin, he is obligated to admit it before God. It's not enough to change your ways. You actually have to say to God, I did it. And he quotes you a biblical verse, they shall admit the sin they performed. This is verbal admission. This verbal admission fulfills a commandment. There's a lot of literature on whether there's a mitzvah of repenting, or if you want to repent, this is the way to do it. I'm not going into that right now. We generally, the conclusion tends to be, no, there is a mitzvah of repentance. Whether it's part of each mitzvah in the Torah, like if you broke this, then repent, or whether it's a standalone, is its own discussion. But it's clear that in terms of the relationship with God, there is a duty to acknowledge what one did, and that includes apology. It's not just, hey, God, I did this. And also socially, there's a very strong imperative. If you take a look at source number 13, also from Maimonides, social transgressions, like wounding another person, cursing him, stealing from him, and the like, are never forgiven until he gives the other what he owes, and he appeases him. You also have to appease the other party. And we are taught that God is not going to forgive somebody until the other person has forgiven someone. You also see it in source number 14, where Maimonides talks about if you wound an individual and the requirement of apologizing. There's a little bit of controversy because of what he says here. He distinguishes between harming physically and harming financially. And he seems to say harming financially doesn't need an apology, just pay them, which contradicts what he wrote in source number 13. So the commentators deal with that and explain it. But I brought this because I wanted to show you the gravity of what he says here. If you look in 14, the third line, even if he brings all of the rams of Nevaiot, for meaning as ritual sacrifices, it's a phrase from Isaiah chapter 60, he has not atoned, his guilt is not forgiven until he seeks forgiveness from the victim who forgives him. That's the rule. So there is a duty to apologize, and when one does not apologize, they get into big, big trouble, right? My favorite example, my bar mitzvah haftorah, was the Parsha of Zachor, the one that's read every year before Purim, in which we read that King Saul was supposed to lead a war against Amalek. He did not do as God told him to do. God tells the prophet Samuel, Saul broke the rules. Samuel goes to Saul and says to him, what in the world have you done? And they go through three go-rounds of conversation with Saul giving excuses. It was the nation. It was this. It was that. Before he finally says, Chatasi, I sinned. And the end of that chapter is that he loses the throne. He apologized the first time round. Don't wait till round number three. It's not a good idea. We're going to talk more about this when we get to the next issue about messaging. But from a Jewish perspective, there absolutely is a duty to apologize. Thank you for waiting, Mark. What did you want to say?
Was this apology before? If the accused is adamant that he's innocent and you're apologizing on behalf, first of all, are you judge and jury? And secondly, are you incurring liability? You've thrown him under the bus.
So when I say, when I'm talking about you, the lawyer is not acting independently. It's a really bad idea. I think I can say this safely. Lawyers, correct me if I'm wrong. It's a really bad idea if the lawyer is on a different page from the client and decides to act on their page. So the lawyer issues an apology while the client is not on board. Please don't try that.
Even if they are on board, he hasn't had his day in court.
Right, so that's a separate point, is the issue of timing of the apology. What about the fear that you prejudice the case? So we're coming to that. It's a good question. Just hang in there. Those who have already invoked the Apology Act know where I'm going with that one. But right now what we're saying is there absolutely is an imperative to apologize. But now let's talk about the flip side. The flip side is apologies might be construed as admission of guilt. In secular law, an apology which states you were negligent can get you into trouble. Now, I'm only dealing right now with U.S. law. I'm not dealing with Canadian because I want to come back to the Apology Act. But I want to show the way that this plays out. And in that article that I quoted before, Legal Consequences of Apologizing, if you take a look at source number 15, they note, first of all, they note before the part that I brought here, that apologies are admissible as evidence in court. If you apologize, and again, this is not Apology Act regime, this is general. Apologies made personally can be brought into court as evidence. There's a case of medical malpractice, which is discussed in that article. It's source number 15. Senesac v. Associates in Obstetrics and Gynecology. So this was 1982. The Supreme Court of Vermont held that a doctor's admission of a mistake... Well, let me actually introduce it better. I need to qualify what I'm about to say. It's a case in which an apology is considered admissible as evidence. However, this goes back to the point that Gwendolyn made before. It's all in what you admit you did. And this is a case in which the fact that a doctor apologized for doing something wrong did not mean that the doctor was actually negligent. It just meant that they had made a mistake, and they were acknowledging the mistake and saying they felt bad for it. It doesn't mean that they're saying that what they did was negligent. Not all mistakes are negligent. So take a look at number 15. Now, the 1982 decision, the Supreme Court of Vermont held that a doctor's admission of a mistake did not automatically prove the doctor departed from the appropriate standards of medical care. June of 1973, defendant Mary Jane Gray performed a therapeutic abortion upon plaintiff Mary Senesac. During the procedure, Gray perforated Senesac's uterus, had to perform an emergency hysterectomy. Gray allegedly apologized to Senesac shortly after the operation, saying she had, quote, made a mistake, she was sorry, and this had never happened before. Flip the page. At trial, Senesac introduced no expert medical testimony to show that Gray departed from the standard of care ordinarily exercised by the average reasonably skillful gynecologist. She attempted to satisfy this element of the tort with the admission of mistake in the apology. There was no evidence of negligence. Besides, they said sorry. The trial court ordered a directed verdict in favor of the defendant, the doctor. Senesac appealed the granting of the motion for a directed verdict. On appeal, Senesac argued the directed verdict was improper. The jury could reasonably have concluded from Gray's statement that she had admitted negligence. The Supreme Court of Vermont, in reviewing the directed verdict, assumed without deciding the apology had actually occurred. There was no question. There really was an apology. The court acknowledged that it is possible for a plaintiff to win without expert medical testimony when the defendant's own testimony establishes the standard of care and subsequent departure. If the doctor actually said, I was negligent, they could get into trouble with that. However, they affirm the directed verdict because Gray's statement did not establish a departure from the standards of care and skill ordinarily exercised by physicians in similar cases. The court saw this statement as simply being the physician's belief and expression of the belief that her performance was not in accordance with her own personal standards of care and skill. I've never done this before. I've never had that happen. This statement, without additional expert medical evidence, was not enough to establish the second element of the tort. That's the argument. The argument is, if you avoid saying something that's going to get you into trouble, you'll be fine. However, you can get into trouble otherwise. If you word it wrong, you can get into trouble. And this is something that you find in Jewish law as well. We have two different laws, depending on whether you're dealing with a religious sin or a civil issue, criminal versus civil, essentially. In a criminal proceeding in Judaism, your apology cannot be used against you. We have a general principle. I brought it from the Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 16. Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. You are considered to be a relative of yourself. And Ein Adam Mesim Atzmo Rasha. You can't declare yourself to be a wicked person. There's no such thing. The rule is that you didn't... your testimony is as though it had never happened. You follow? In a criminal proceeding in Judaism, you can't be held liable based on your own admission. However, when you get to a civil proceeding, you can be held liable. Hodas Baal Din, source number 17, also from the Talmud, Hodas Baal Din Kameya Edim Dami. If you admit something, it's like there are 100 witnesses. So you apologized, you admitted that you owed somebody something, that can be used against you. That's true within Judaism. We actually do have such a concern. Apologizing can get you into trouble. So in Jewish law, there's no way to mitigate that, except it's a matter of your soul versus your pocketbook, right? There's a line in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I should have actually brought it, about somebody who wins a case, somebody who loses a case and ends up needing to pay, should leave court whistling and singing because he saved himself from becoming a thief. Right? You should be really happy if you lose. So don't worry about your apology getting you into trouble. You're better off for having apologized. In Canada, not broadly federally, but provincially, I know of several provinces with this. I don't know if all provinces have it. I don't know if the Winnipeggers can clue us in.
Manitoba,
yes?
Manitoba has it.
So there is something indeed called, as Michael referenced before, the Apology Act. And the Apology Act I thought that this was so Canadian when I first learned about it. And I say that not in a negative way. I say that in a very positive way.
It's the I'm Sorry Act.
You have to pronounce it right. But this goes back to 2009 in Ontario. Hang on, my computer just did something funny as I was trying to post the link for the source sheet again. There we go. Okay, so this goes back to 2009 in Ontario, and what it does is to say that in a civil proceeding, or an administrative proceeding, or an arbitration, an apology is not admissible as evidence of guilt. In order to encourage people to apologize, because we said apologizing is good, and apologizing is beneficial. So in order to make sure that people will apologize, we are going to make it easier for them to do so. So if you look at source number 18, which I pulled from the text of the Act, despite any other act or law, evidence of an apology made by or on behalf of a person in connection with any matter is not admissible in any civil proceeding, administrative proceeding, or arbitration as evidence of the fault or liability of any person in connection with that matter. There are exceptions to this rule. When testifying in a civil proceeding, your apology does count. Don't apologize under oath. They apologize in advance. Do not apologize on the witness stand. Also, in a criminal proceeding, it's actually the flip side of the Jewish approach, right? In Judaism, we said apology in a criminal proceeding will not get you into trouble, only in a civil proceeding. However, here, it's actually the opposite. In the criminal proceeding, yes, the apology can get you into trouble. You are acknowledging what you did. So those are important exceptions to the rule. But the bottom line out of what we've said is that you are actually relatively safe apologizing in Ontario, in Manitoba. Just don't do it under oath. That's really what we're telling you is don't do it on the stand, and also if it's a criminal case, you have issues, you know, and of course civil cases can involve criminal conduct, so I don't know how that plays out, right? Like in our case, the director who apologized is going to face criminal charges. So I don't know how that'll work. Yes,
so
Ben.
Our case seems to be that the board of the organization seems to be negligent with respect to the actions.
Right.
The lawyer is advising the board, not this.
Exactly.
Who I presume is fired at this point.
So I would
the
hope.
Apology coming from the organization presumably should be careful not to admit criminal liability. Now, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I don't know what crime, because it seems like the organization was defrauded. Fraud is a crime, so this guy probably shouldn't apologize for the fraud if he wants to avoid criminal liability. To the point about Seoul, maybe he does. But the organization is probably safe in admitting we missed this and we're sorry about that and we will implement new things unless there's some sort of crime of negligence in administering a charity.
I don't know. Anybody know whether negligence in administering a charity can constitute criminal conduct? Could there be criminal liability for that? Anybody know? Sorry? So I have an I doubt it from Alan here. I think that what you're saying substantively is correct. What Ben is saying here is that the lawyer for Fund Jewish, Susan, in our case, can issue an apology for Fund Jewish that is careful to avoid acknowledging any criminal responsibility. Anything that if there could be. You know, and she's not speaking for Richard. Richard has his own lawyer and is going to have to deal with things himself. But I think that's a correct assessment. Questions or comments online about this case before we move into number three?
Yeah, can I just throw in?
Yeah, Michael.
You mentioned about the American situation.
Yeah.
This is a very Canadian act, the Apology Act. If I'm remembering correctly, I was kind of involved a bit back when that act was passed. If I'm remembering correctly, it was already, it wasn't something we invented in Canada. It actually came from the U.S., if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if it's usually done as standalone legislation. It's a very, very short act, right?
Yeah.
I think it's usually part of the Evidence Act in the jurisdiction. But
really?
That's just kind of my off-the-cuff remembering. So I think it's widespread, and I think it actually originated in the U.S.
Thank you, Michael, because that's very interesting. I looked to see if this was in the U.S. I didn't look in all jurisdictions, obviously. I didn't find anything. So if you could just send me at some point anything you have on American roots for it, I would feel better. So
I'll look for it. Yeah, I'm curious myself. It's been a long time. It's been over a decade. So
yeah.
I could actually be just imagining it.
All right. Well, and thank you for your role in creating the Apology Act, because I think it's cool.
Yeah, I'm really sorry.
There you go. Okay.
It doesn't sound very American. I don't know.
Ooh, that wasn't nice. Okay.
And I wasn't responsible. I was just consulting.
Okay. All right. Let's move into the third vignette. This one also is one that I enjoyed. So, if you take a look back in the beginning of the sheet. Situational crisis communication theory. This is, I'm going to just keep saying SCCT. I'm not going to say the whole name. Claims that we can anticipate what sort of response to a crisis would be effective with the public. Now, pausing here, there are lots of approaches to crisis management and crisis communications. This isn't the only one by any stretch of the imagination. What caught my eye with this one is the abundance of literature on it, and the fact that it's very systematic. in the way that they approach it, and not just like sort of the obvious, you know, types of things that you just throw out that occur to you off the cuff. So they claim you can anticipate what type of response will be effective while being minimally expensive for the entity in crisis, because that's also a concern. Right? It's very easy. You can resolve any crisis by writing checks, but that's not necessarily warranted, and it's expensive, and in certain cases, it can blow up in your face, as we'll see. In some situations, an organization could successfully navigate a crisis without accepting responsibility. How could Susan use SCCT to help Fund Jewish deflect and mitigate blame for its current crisis? What would Judaism say about this approach? So we're going to first, before I start polling people, because I want to explain what it is that I have in mind. This begins with something called attribution theory. Attribution theory is a theory developed in the latter half of the 20th century. And what it says is people assign blame for negative events in predictable ways. Something bad happens, even though in reality there may not be someone to blame. Sometimes things just go wrong, and everybody did the best they could, and yet there was an event that was out of their control. But that's not the way human beings work. There's always somebody at whom you could point a finger. So there was a massive earthquake. Yeah, but this was a fault line. You should have known about the construction. Somebody came along and attacked a restaurant. Yeah, well, it was the person who sold him the gun. It was the government that didn't legislate properly. I am not weighing in, by the way, on either of those cases, the earthquake or the attack. My point is only to say that naturally we look for a guilty party. We say there must be somebody to blame. That's part of this attribution theory. And therefore, we tend to view the parties involved as either villain or victim, right? Either you're a villain, it's your fault this happened, or you're a victim, this was done by somebody else to you. And what SCC, I brought that in number 19 from this article, Protecting Organization Reputation During a Crisis, the Development and Application of SCCT, in source number 19. You can read it there. What SCCT, let me just ask. Anybody familiar with SCCT beforehand, before this session? Okay, so I can make up whatever I want. That's basically what you're telling me. Okay, no. I'm going to try to be true to the literature. SCCT applies some of the concepts of attribution theory to guide those who are trying to communicate after or during a crisis. They acknowledge that as a matter of ethics, the first thing you have to do is not worry about your reputation and your messaging. The first thing you have to do is take care of those who might be harmed. So if you take a look at number 20, I brought you their write-up on it. They say, the first priority in any crisis is to protect stakeholders from harm, not to protect the reputation. Instructing information tells stakeholders what they must do to protect themselves from the physical threat of a crisis. Examples would be telling consumers not to eat contaminated foods, or warning sirens alerting people to a chemical release, the need to shelter in place. Instructing information can be delivered directly to stakeholders or through news media. And then you have adapting information. Adapting information helps people to cope with the psychological threat from the crisis. A crisis creates a need for information. The uncertainty of a crisis produces stress for stakeholders. To cope with the psychological stress, stakeholders need information about what had just happened. Furthermore, stakeholders want to know what is being done to protect them from similar crises in the future. Corrective actions reassure stakeholders that they are safe, thereby reducing their psychological stress. A final component of adjusting information is an expression of concern for the victims. They don't mean adjusting, they mean adapting. It's a mistake in their article. I cut and pasted. All right. Expressions of concern are expected by stakeholders and recommended by crisis experts, but are not admissions of guilt. Not talking about saying, I am guilty, but saying, are you okay? Reaching out to those who could be harmed is ethical as well as a good idea. So once you've done that, you provided instructing information to help people protect themselves. You provided adapting information telling them how to protect themselves from psychological fallout. You've expressed your concern for them. What happens next? So SCCT argues that there are three key factors influencing how stakeholders view the organization in crisis. And I drew on Combs's paper in sources 21, 22, 23. I just gave you bullet point lists. Number one is initial blame for the current crisis. Do they think this was in your control? And they identify three types of crisis. You have the victim cluster of crisis, things where you could be realistically viewed as a victim. You were attacked by something or somebody. Natural disaster, someone started a rumor about the company, workplace violence, product tampering. Second type is accident, where you're a little bit more responsible, but it wasn't intentional and you weren't careless. Accidents happen, technical error. Or is it something preventable? Were you careless? Was there actually somebody in the organization who did this on purpose? So depending on how people decide what happened, that will shape their response to you. Do they think you're a victim? Do they think you're a villain? And to what degree? Because it's never clear cut. That's number one. That's key factor number one. Who do we blame for the crisis? Number two, this goes back to what we said in our first vignette. What's your history of past crises? How have you dealt with them in the past? Have you had a similar crisis in the past? If you have, that signals a problem that hasn't been addressed. It's one thing when Richard redirects the funds into his pocket and everybody says, wow, that's never happened in this organization. What if Richard's successor does it? Now what? At a certain point, you have to ask, is there a problem that's not being addressed? That can lead stakeholders to go from viewing it as an attack on the organization to an accident or to carelessness. And then the third point is the relationship with the stakeholders before the crisis. How did you deal with things the last time there was a crisis? Did you take care of people? That's going to lead to a much more positive response from people, and it can help people to view something as less bad or more bad. And of course, the more they see you as a villain, the more likely they are to harm your organization going forward. Not buying your product, saying bad things about you, not using your services, whatever the case may be. So what you need to do is choose a response strategy which minimizes harm to reputation and helps build a positive reputation with a minimal cost, right? That's what SCCT is going to say. So they identify three primary response strategies. There is denial. Crisis? What crisis? Or it's not me, it was Richard who did it. Richard's the bad guy and we're the good guys and I don't know what you're talking about. There is diminishing the crisis. Yes, there's a problem, but it didn't cause that much harm. He only was able to do this for a week before we caught him. Or we were able to recover the funds. Or yes, there was one problem in our protocols and we've solved it. So you try to make it less than it is. And then there is rebuild. Rebuild is we need to rebuild the community's trust. So this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to compensate people. We're apologizing. This is the greatest taking of responsibility, but of course it is also the most expensive. Combs actually quotes a study that says that in a case of an accident, full apologies don't do any better than just providing people with information about what happened and how to cope with it. If it's an accident, no one's blaming you, and therefore an apology isn't really necessary. It doesn't have any better results. But that's the primary strategy, deny or diminish or rebuild. And then last, within the introduction to SCCT, this is a kind of a crash course, is the secondary strategy. This is something they call bolstering. It's basically reinforcing what you want people to know about your organization and about what went wrong. So highlight the fact that you are a victim, if in fact you are a victim. Remind them of past good works and praise your stakeholders, especially the supportive ones. Help them to feel good about the fact that they're supporting you. So applying this to the fund Jewish situation, right? Richard took funds. Susan is now counseling them. How can she apply this to the case? If you go back to vignette number one, we said then about Fund Jewish that, number one, they benefit the needy. This is a cause that people can get behind. Number two, they have an excellent community reputation for quality of service, integrity, communication with stakeholders. So they check the boxes. We don't have past crises. Their track record is great. Their relationships with stakeholders are very good as well. The fact that they have a good track record was actually vignette number two. The organization has never experienced anything like this. So they've never experienced anything like this. It's never happened. And there was no history of it for Richard. Like, they couldn't have known anything. So on that basis, do you think they need to issue an apology? Based on what we're saying in this SCCT approach, is there a need for them to actually apologize? Those online, what do you say?
I say probably yes, that they should apologize. They've got enough information behind them so that the apology is not going to damage them. It could only help them. It's not a question of giving out information on how to deal with it, which might be a reason not to apologize. There's no reason not to apologize.
So Michael number one, because we've got, for those in the room, there are two Michaels. I don't know if you're able to identify that. Michael number one is the more ruthless. Not in this case. Michael says that apologizing is a good idea. There's no information to give the public to protect themselves. But apologizing is a good idea. That's Michael's take. Yes, Ben.
So I think this falls in the preventable cluster. Any sort of financial expenditure by a charity, if it's only got one person who's able to sign off without other people checking off in the moment, I think that sort of falls in a very preventable way. Like, I know with my firm, you can't get money out the door without at least two people looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's still imperfect. Like, two people could collaborate, but it seems to me that this is very preventable, and so there's at least culpability of the organization to the donors and to the recipients of not having a process in place that would have caught this, and that process sort of in retrospect, but maybe even before retrospect, seems kind of obvious.
Right. So Ben argues this fits in the preventable cluster because you didn't have a protocol that kept Richard from pocketing the money. So he would actually not view this as an accident. He'd view this as presentable. Noting still, I assume, that you have the mitigation of the track record and the good relations with stakeholders.
And the fact pattern specifically says the leadership missed the warning signs because
right.
Richard was giving incomplete financial information. So from a Jewish perspective, they have to own that.
Right. So Gwendolyn points out that it's true. He wasn't giving complete financial information at the meetings. That is the warning sign. That is why we call this preventable. And you talk about it in terms of check writing procedures, but in terms of just reporting procedures, he wasn't up to the standards. It could be they've been doing it for 50 years and they're tired and they've had situations in which people have missed reporting things fully just because they were lazy or they were busy or whatever and nothing bad happened. So they were numb to the problem, but fundamentally, this is something that could have been prevented by simply maintaining procedure. And so the argument that it's preventable is certainly a legitimate argument here from a Jewish perspective, because here we get into the other question, which is, even if SCCT says you don't need to apologize, you can get away without apologizing, where will Judaism come out with its insistence that we talked about in vignette number two on apologies? How will you deal with it from that perspective? So So I would say that I think from the perspective of SCCT, it's true that you can read this as being in the preventable cluster. On the other hand, you have your good track record. I think you might be able to get away with diminishing and simply saying, you know, it's the first time in 50 years and he only got away for a little bit of time and, you know, we had no reason to suspect this and move on and try to build a new track record, you know, afterwards. You know, you start your clock again for a number of days since there was an accident and that's the way it goes. Alan, you...
Exactly what you said, other than the communication, would shift some of the blame to him, would indicate we're doing everything we can to recover it, and we are tightening up our systems to make sure it doesn't happen on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, so Alan gives us the communication as we are doing our, we're taking steps to recover the money. We have implemented protocols to make sure this doesn't happen again. We are a victim, right? Right.
And we're putting systems in place to make sure it never happens again.
Right. We are a victim and we are putting systems in place to make sure it doesn't happen again. And there's no apology. That would be a strategy. I am definitely biased towards doing the apology. And that not just from a Jewish perspective also, I think, in terms of the fact that it was preventable, but certainly from a Jewish perspective. On the one hand, guilt for the crime lies with Richard. In other words, the fact that you didn't keep your protocols doesn't change the fact that he's the thief. You left the door open, wasn't so smart, but at the end of the day, he's the thief, and we have a principle, Ein shliach l'dvar avera. There's no such thing as an agent for sin. The one who carries out the sin is the one who is liable. That, you know, he was intelligent and he made the decision. Maybe you could argue, I'm rethinking this, because that was what I had said in my notes, but I'm rethinking it a little bit, because when you are careless with other people's funds, right, that are entrusted to you, that is a violation of a trust. So maybe in that sense there is, maybe I should argue that there is indeed, you are what's called in Hebrew, fundamentally, a shomer sachar. You are guarding, and you are being paid to guard the assets that they entrusted to you. It's not quite that, because they're not, the assets don't belong to those people anymore. These assets now are on their way to whoever the recipient should be, who also doesn't own them yet. But I think it's fair to argue that the apology would be required, because yes, you did betray a trust in that sense. The argument could be made.
I'm rethinking something as well, but thinking back, you know, with that burning made of disaster,
yeah,
how many Jewish organizations were taken down?
Yeah.
I'm not in a position to know this, but I don't remember anybody apologizing. Everybody was a victim.
So,
and
I don't remember. It would be an interesting question. Michael number one wants to know how many organizations that had invested with Bernie Madoff apologized to their stakeholders afterwards. So, all right, so Alan is in the middle of sending me an email asking me why you apologized for the fact that they had invested with Madoff. So, the answer is I don't know. But we are taught within Judaism to accept full responsibility for our errors through multiple cases in Tanakh. We have loads of negative examples. I gave you four in source number 25 on the sheet, right? Cain kills his brother. And then God comes to him and says, where is your brother, right? Where is Abel, your brother? And his answer is, lo yadati, I don't know. Followed by, of course, the famous words, hashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper? So that's a case of denial, which did not work so well. But we also have cases of diminishing. Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, right? God comes back to Adam and says, did you eat from that fruit? I told you not to eat. And he says, the woman you gave me, she's the one who did it. And she's the one who made me do it. And then God goes to Eve and she says, the snake convinced me to do it. That's a full-blown diminishing. And again, doesn't go well. Aaron, after the golden calf, Moshe comes down the mountain and he says to him, what in the world have you done? And Aaron's answer is, oh, you know this nation, they are bad people and they did this and they did this and they did this. That's another case of diminishing, and he gets into trouble, right? Moshe needs to pray for him to bail him out. And if you look at the version of the story that appears in Devarim at the end of the Torah, Moshe actually says that's why Aaron doesn't make it into the land of Israel. Because of this. There's more to be said about that. And then, of course, the example I gave before with King Saul and Amalek, saying the nation intimidated me into this decision. So we have lots of negative examples in Tanakh. What happens when you don't apologize or apologize sufficiently? But we also have positive examples, specifically from King David. King David is the king of apologizing. And you might say, well, it would be better if you didn't do it in the first place. Noted. Nonetheless, King David is on the run from King Saul, right? We have this problem where you've anointed the new king while the old king is still alive. Never a good idea, definitely not in the Middle East. So King Saul is pursuing King David, and David is on the run. He needs food, he needs a weapon. He goes into the Mishkan, into the tabernacle. He fools the high priest into supplying him. He says to him, I'm on a mission from King Saul. High priest gives him the stuff, he leaves, but he sees a man named Doeg there. And Doeg works for and is close with King Saul. Doeg goes and tells Saul that the priests helped David. I'm taking a long story and making it short. He tells him the priests helped David. Saul has the city massacred. There's only one survivor. The survivor flees to King David and tells him what happened. And David says, I knew it. When I saw Doeg there in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, I knew it. It's my fault that this happened. He apologizes. It's in, I gave you the reference there. Samuel 1, 21 is the story where he is, where David is there. 22 is the massacre. And the end of chapter 22 is when he pins it. He doesn't say, that terrible Saul, that terrible Doeg. He says, it's my fault. I knew that this was going to happen when I was there. He blames himself. Later on, there's a general for, I'm at 10:55. I'm not going to get to the vignette number 4, which I knew I wasn't going to get to anyway. I said, if there's time. That was the transparency vignette. We can discuss that another time. Just know that in Judaism, with a public trust, we push for transparency. That's basically what I wanted to say. But in terms of examples of taking responsibility, so after Saul dies, he has a son, Ishbosheth, who is actually being supported for the throne by a general named Avner. So David is supposed to be getting the throne. Saul's son, Ishbosheth, is claiming the throne, supported by a general named Avner. Avner switches sides. He comes over to support King David. David accepts him, says, you're in our camp now. And then David's other general, his existing general, Yoav, goes out and murders Avner, claiming that he's doing it to protect David because Avner is for sure a spy. But there's more between Yoav and Avner, not for right now. My point is what happens after that. David takes a public action to demonstrate he was not a part of what happened. He rebukes Yoav publicly. He eulogizes Avner. He goes out himself to follow the casket, and he fasts the day of the funeral, all intending to say, I am not behind this. I feel terrible that this happened. He's taking a measure of responsibility for it. The best example of David's apology is after what happens with him and Uriah and Bathsheba, right? The story in which King David ends up taking a married woman for himself. And yes, technically speaking, he can be exonerated. There was a divorce. There was a conditional divorce. You can come up with all the explanations which we have to show that he didn't break the law technically. However, the prophet Nathan comes to David afterwards, and he gives him a parable about a wealthy man taking advantage of an indigent man. And he says, David, how would you judge in that case? And David says, you should kill the wealthy man. How dare he take advantage of the indigent one? And Nathan says to him, you are the man in that story. And his response is not to equivocate and not to buy time and not to diminish. His response is, Chatasi, I sinned. I'm guilty. It's an immediate response. And unfortunately, it doesn't get him out of trouble. Because
the entire... an apology to the person he wronged. Right?
Correct.
This is... taking responsibility towards God, with respect to God. Like, he doesn't apologize to Bathsheba.
Right, so Raquel says at that stage, hang in there one second, you gotta let me finish the story. At that stage, he has not, that's his conversation with Nathan. He goes on to apologize to Bathsheba. That you have the dialogue with them afterwards, and ultimately they're married, and she doesn't seem to be upset about that. They, as you read the story as it plays out between David and Bathsheba, all the way into Malachim, into the Book of Kings, this doesn't seem like a hostile relationship. I recognize that people have read into it lots of things that aren't in the text. They on many different sides. But reading it from the text itself, it doesn't look like things are bad between the two of them afterwards. What you do see is, number one, and this is where what I was saying, is that the rest of Samuel 2 plays out the demolition of his household. So the abuse of one of his children by another child, the murder of one of his children by another child, two rebellions by his children against his throne, the death of one of those rebels. Everything in his life is blown up afterwards as a consequence of it. I am not claiming that he gets off scot-free because he apologized. But my point is to say, he is a serial apologizer. When things go wrong, he apologizes for it. And that, I think, is the model that we're meant to take. And I brought you in source number 27, last source on this, as we're at time, the passage in the Jerusalem Talmud in which we are told that we have a duty to take extra steps to remain innocent in the eyes of the public. Not remain innocent in the eyes of the public by hiding what we've done wrong, but to actually be innocent in the eyes of the public, make sure that our conduct is above board, which may also warrant apologizing even when you could have gotten away with diminishing responsibility. So my answer to Susan in this case would be, it could be SCCT would tell you can get away with diminishing. From a Jewish perspective, I would rather see the apology. I would rather see the apology, especially when it can't expose you to legal harm, as we discussed in vignette number two. That would have been my approach based on what we're seeing here. As we said in vignette number four, in terms of transparency, we have concerns in Judaism about transparency. We have a big emphasis on confidentiality. You're not allowed to share information inappropriately in Jewish law. I gave you, I think, source number 28 and number 29 to that effect. Nonetheless, when you're dealing with public funds, we do push for transparency and accounting. This is a balance that has to be struck, and it'll be discussed, I guess, hopefully on some other occasion. Thank you very much, everyone. And appreciate your participation. God willing, we'll be sending out credit letters in the next 2 weeks for the classes since January. Again, if you didn't sign in, make sure you sign in, please, in the chat. I'll leave it open for a few minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi.